Good morning. It's Tuesday, March 19th, and we're here for the Story County Board of Supervisors regular Tuesday meeting. I will call it to order. Would those of you who care to join us in saying the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, I'd like to begin here with public comment number one. Is there anyone interested in coming up and making a comment about either something on today's agenda or something else that you'd like to bring up first thing this morning? Seeing no, and from the two members of the public. So we'll go ahead and we'll move on to agency reports. And we're going to start with Lutheran Services in Iowa, Alyssa Barton. Good morning. Yes, please come sit right up there. And we ask you to speak directly into the long neck mouth mic. It is a little sensitive, and it really likes you to talk right into it. Thanks, Alyssa.
No problem. So I'm the service coordinator for Lutheran Services in Iowa's early childhood programming. And with Story County funds, that helps fund our crisis child care program. And just a brief overview of what that is. We work with families in Story County that have children ages 0 to 12 and are experiencing a crisis. They call our phone. We have it on 24/7. Once we make touch with them, we do an enrollment process with them. We call our in-home registered daycare providers that we work with throughout Story County to see if anybody can help that family during their crisis to place their child with them for up to 72 hours. So this fiscal year, July till the end of February, we have done 1,246.25 hours in Story County, and that is with 14 different families and 28 different children. And this year we've exhausted our Story County funds, and so that just kind of shows that it is still a much needed program, and that this year we've actually exceeded what we did last year by 105 hours, and that's just through the end of February, so we still have a couple months left going. But one of the challenges that we have been facing this year that we've started to kind of keep track of, because we do serve both Story and Boone County, so between the two, we've actually had to turn away 17 different families. The majority of those are Story County families because of the crisis, or the child care crisis in Story County, meaning that there are more children being born than there are child care spots. So we have a lot of our providers that, when they used to not always be full, they could take our kids during the daytime. Now they're full constantly, and the second they have a kid drop out or whatever the case is, they're full again. So during the daytime, it's been extremely tough for us to place children. And so actually during the nights and weekends is our best shot for placing a child, which is actually the opposite of most programs. Usually weekends and nights are the hardest. And so that's what we have run into, especially with the number of child care providers decreasing in Story County. So that's just something that we advocate for, and then we like to show the public to make them aware if they don't know that that's going on. And so we are seeing an increased number of people that we've had to turn away. We've never had to turn away that many people that I can remember, but we never really started actually keeping track until this year, noticing that the pattern had kind of started last year. So that's just a challenge that we always like people to be aware of in the community. But otherwise, we've been able to serve a lot of families in Story County this year, and it's been a program, and without your guys' funds, you know, those 28 kids might have been in a different situation. So we thank you.
Okay, thank you. That was nice and kind of put all of your information together. Board, any comments or questions?
Who else, what other agencies or units of government fund your program?
What other agencies?
Mm-hmm.
So we get asset funding and we get boost funding.
Okay.
For the ACI board, yeah.
So all of it's either asset?
Mm-hmm.
And you said you utilized the county funds totally.
Yep.
Do you have other funds yet available for this fiscal year?
Yes, we do. Not much. Obviously it's the last year, we didn't do as many hours, mm-hmm. so we didn't get as much funds. And so we're almost to the end. But, you know, one example is January, we did 625 hours of care, which is the most we've ever done in a given month throughout the years. February, we did 0 hours. So that's how much crisis care fluctuates, because you, of course, never know when somebody's going to be in a crisis. So I'm assuming we're going to use up the rest of our funds for this year, but obviously I can't say for sure. So.
Okay. And once you get a referral, do you have an average time, how long it takes you to get a child placed and for a child?
It depends on the needs. So sometimes we have a family, like for instance, we had a mom who had a scheduled C-section. So we knew this was the date that she needed care, so we had time to kind of call as many people, you know, so that's a different time frame than if we have somebody call that needs placement that night, then we start calling immediately to find a place, especially if, you know, they need help transporting, that sort of thing. So sometimes a crisis can be scheduled and sometimes it's not. So if it's an immediate situation, we call immediately and we place that child as soon as we can.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Well, I did, although your response to Supervisor Merkin kind of made me realize how many layers there are to the situation.
Yeah.
Because I was going to ask about if there was increased funding, you know, would that address it? But if there's no availability of a provider, it really doesn't matter how much money there is.
Right.
So it's us continuing to look to some of the nonprofit agencies and the asset admin team, et cetera, to try and see how moving forward, suggestions on how to increase providers.
Okay.
Just one more on a big list.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay. All right. But thank you for your efforts, because that has got to be tough to get a call at 4 in the afternoon and find out you need to put a child somewhere in 3 hours. So, okay. All right. Thank you. Yeah. Keith Morgan, our quarterly emergency management report. Have a good day, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Although winter months are supposed to be our easier time, continual winter weather events in February and March have challenged my office. For instance, on February 24th and 25th, Story County faced one of the most powerful winter storms we've had in a long time. And our office began to coordinate messaging almost immediately to let the public sector know the risk that was impending and to give them some ideas on how they might mitigate that risk. We also started working with Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau to monitor hotel availability, which did not look good. The information on the room availability pushed us to go ahead and contact our RATs, the Rapid Action Teams for Sheltering, to kind of put them on standby should we need shelter. At 10 a.m. on Sunday, I-35 did close with a little advance notice to us, and we immediately activated the plan that we have put together for this. This plan directs cars to South 16th, where there's the hotel rooms, and also tries to push the semis to go down to Hilton Coliseum, and we've coordinated with Iowa State University to try and keep that parking lot open so we have a place to have those semis go to. Our amateur radio and emergency service group began to broadcast on CBs directions to the truckers so that they would know where to go when they got up here. And as the storm progressed, we continued to collect information and disseminate it. We put out on our Facebook page an update on Monday morning on the road conditions, which reached over 32,000 people. Oftentimes, I've kind of pondered and how difficult it is for many to understand what emergency management is and why it's necessary to invest time and resources into emergency management. And I think our response to this winter storm, which integrated many different agencies across all of Story County, demonstrates why pre-planning, training, and exercises, often led by our department, is an investment that pays off. As I've also indicated, there were issues discussed in the after action that still need to be addressed. The expansion of the integration of our plan into the overall Iowa DOT I-35 closure plan is one place where we need to do some work. Also, improved training for those that activate the plan and development of contingency parking plans should Iowa State be having a sporting event at the same time we're trying to put semis in that parking lot. All our after-action items that we will be working on in the near future. Another area that we're working on is disaster assessment and volunteer management. It's an area where we're...
Keith, before you go there, let's spend just a second there. How was our response from those we rely on? And I'm thinking specifically of what you can tell us about Red Cross, but I know I felt some frustration.
We did have some issues with Red Cross. Our plan was pretty specific that if we had one or two individuals that were stranded, that the Red Cross has a process where they can provide vouchers to those individuals so they might be sheltered. And we had a situation like that in Story City. When we went to activate that that process, which is in the plan and which was discussed in October, as we always review the plan before the season starts, they refused to do that. So we had a law enforcement officer up in Story City who, out of his own pocket, paid for that sheltering. It's one of the areas that we're going to be looking at, because if we have these reviews of the plans, and if there are roles and responsibilities, we've got to depend on those people to follow through on it. So we will be having discussions. We are going to look at what our options are to be able to make sure that we don't have something like that happen again. Another example of how we're constantly working through emergency management cycle of planning, preparing, response, and recovery is our efforts to improve our damage assessment and volunteer management. Last summer, we assisted Polk County during their floods, and we got a chance to observe processes they use to handle damage assessment. And damage assessment is important in a number of different ways. It allows us to determine at first the situation so we can get the right resources to the right place. Long term, it allows us to take volunteers and assign them to needs that are out there, and also to develop a recovery plan for the community that might be impacted. Along with that, we also heard from our partner, the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program, about their experiences with volunteer management after the Marshalltown tornado. Through both of these events, we identified new processes that could be used here in Story County to improve our capabilities to respond and recover from a disaster. On the damage assessment side, the deputy, Melissa Spencer, has been working with Homeland Security, Ames, and Story County GIS, and also our secondary roads and conservation folks, to integrate a new damage assessment app. We're going to capitalize on technology to allow folks to go out there on site, do what used to be done by paper, have it feed automatically into an overall spreadsheet that will allow us to both graphically demonstrate where the damages occur and also to allow us to electronically capture the scale and scope of those damages. She has put together a beta version of how we're going to integrate this, and she's putting together a training package so that we can work and use secondary roads and conservation as our guinea pig. And if it works well, then we're going to roll it out for the entire county. Meanwhile, I've been working with RSVP to integrate an online form to capture information about potential volunteers, spontaneous volunteers, so that we can get the right volunteers to the right place as quickly as possible. Together, RSVP and Emergency Management will be testing this on March 30th as they have one of their volunteer management exercises. The linchpin for our own operations is our Emergency Operations Center, as you well know. And the most important part of our emergency operations center is not the computers, it's not the phones, it's the staff that we have inside of there. And because the skills and knowledge of those staff is essential, and it is perishable, we go ahead and conduct regular training. In January and February, Melissa conducted 3 1.5-hour training sessions to refresh our staff on the use of the tasking sheets and the WebEOC system. Again, thanks to Story County, departments and offices, which allowed their staff to participate in this training. In January, we also saw the final session of the Story County Coop Cog Workshop. I'm sure that was fun and exciting for everybody. The session concentrated on the implementation of the steps that are needed to collect for you the damages that have occurred across multiple facilities and departments, and to collate that so that your Coop Cog management team can make some very, very important decisions rapidly with the information that's available, which is going to be incomplete. The workshop experimented with some processes, and it also highlighted some gaps in procedures. But I've seen that your staff is already working to plug these gaps and correct these deficiencies, and that's very commendable. Finally, our office has been working hard to develop a business resiliency committee here in Story County. The committee is a collaborative effort of the Ames Chamber of Commerce, Safeguard Iowa, and our office, Story County Emergency Management. We've also enjoyed the support of Supervisor Sanders as we have pitched this effort to businesses throughout the community. Our first step was to send out a survey monkey to try and determine the risk that's out there and the level of preparedness amongst the different businesses. We were pleased to have 90 of our businesses respond to this survey, actually over 90 businesses, which provided us some very valuable information on where they're at and what areas they would like us to help them out and to concentrate our efforts on as we move forward. And that's enough looking back. Now let's look forward. In about a week, it'll be Severe Weather Awareness Week. I encourage Story County departments and offices to use this as a chance to pitch individual preparedness to ensure their staff can take care of their family and also continue to support operations here during the disaster. Additionally, on Wednesday, March 27th, there will be a statewide tornado drill. This is a perfect opportunity for all Story County facilities to test their ability to receive a tornado warning, disseminate the warning throughout the building, and to react to the simulated threat appropriately. One relatively new concern of our office is the African swine fever. It's a disease that does not affect humans, but it is deadly to hogs. Fortunately, the disease is not currently in North America, but it is in Africa, Europe, and Asia, to include China, which is one of our main trade partners when it comes to pork and pork products. Our office is representing local emergency management during workshops hosted by the Iowa Department of Land Stewardship and Agriculture, and we will work with the Iowa Pork Producers Association as they develop response plans. We will keep you advised on any issues that could affect Story County with reference to this potential threat. Through the next quarter, we'll be conducting planning on our communications, public information plans, damage assessment and volunteer management, pet sheltering, and school emergency planning. In addition, we will also be participating in exercises related to communications, terrorism, hazmat, and child abduction. And of course, we're going to be monitoring weather. I hope my review of how the work done before an event is critical to preventing or reducing the impact of disasters. I hope it also reinforces in your mind the value of a proactive approach to preparedness for individuals, business, and government. Our office looks forward to working with departments and offices to ensure they are able to respond to the call for assistance during a disaster. With that, I open it up to any questions you might have.
Keith, if you wouldn't mind spending just a second and give my partners kind of the nightmare scenario on swine fever.
Swine fever, as I indicated, has been identified first in Africa. There are even some countries in Europe and, like I said, Asia. This is a disease it's a virus that is a pretty resilient virus. So if it does get into our system, it will be pretty difficult to get rid of it. The first step would be is if it is spotted in North America or in the United States, is that they will probably do a 12-hour period where anything that's on the road with any sort of swine in it would be allowed to move to its final location. After that, they'll do a period of traceback to figure out where the first premise that has the disease had any connections with any other premises, because the concerns of it spreading to those premises. After that, and during that time frame, there will be a lockdown of the travel of swine across the United States. One potential area of problems for us is if there are trucks that are transiting our area, there it may be that their destination is not going to accept it. So we'll have these trucks with hogs on them that won't be accepted where they were at, can't get back to where they're going. After that, if the premise would happen to be here in Story County or in Iowa, it'll be quarantined. And they will go ahead and try and again do those tracebacks, but they will probably have to depopulate that premise, and also will have to do carcass disposal for those premises. On a broader scale, something like this could be absolutely economically devastating for our agriculture. And there is a possibility that producers might walk away from their herds because they cannot afford to keep them. Mm-hmm. Many of these issues would fall upon Story County if it should happen here.
Would we, in that situation, be able to call upon the National Guard or reserves to help handle that depopulation?
When it comes to requests for assistance from the state, we formulate what the mission is, and then they determine what the resource may be. It could be the National Guard if they were the ones to have the equipment that they needed or the personnel. They have changed their focus when it comes to a quarantine. They're not going to lock down a large geographical area. They're going to concentrate on the suspected premises. But some of the other items, again, such as carcass disposal, there may be resources that we would go up to the state for assistance.
This reminds me a little bit when the bird flu. I had a friend who works at the disease laboratories, and they could not figure out for a while how it was spreading.
Correct.
And then a crew happened to be out at a farm and watched a neighbor pull up and drive on the driveway, and there were feathers on the tires, and they figured out it was spreading in this particular area because the farm community was still socializing with each other. And so even though they never drove through their quarantine areas, there still was debris up. So it really, after hearing that story, makes me very concerned about how quickly any type of flu or dangerous organism can spread.
Monday, I'll be working with the Iowa Pork Producers Association, and one of their main efforts is going to be on the biosecurity for the supply chain. And they're going to be addressing things like that. The larger operations, while they are more interconnected, have much more structured processes and biosecurity, both to entry into a site even before anything like this is identified, to ensure that they can try and prevent as much as possible the spread of this and many other diseases. This is not the only threat that we face. There could be foot and mouth disease, many other diseases that are out there. And it is one area that Iowa and across the nation we need to get much better at, because when something like this happens, the international market shut down almost immediately.
If a site is abandoned, whose responsibility is it to get it cleaned up and handle it?
In our last exercise with IDOLs, I asked that question, and it does fall to the county. Okay. So you may become owners of a pork production facility. And that, again, it doesn't have to be one that is a suspect premise. If we had a major drop in pork prices, they're running on such a fine margin. Or even if they just have to stop movement for an extended period, these operations are... have a very thin margin of being able to adjust to something like this.
Okay. Well, thank you. I assume that the emergency management group will continue to move forward in trying to figure out how to react to that bee.
I do have one question.
Yes.
Is IDOLS doing a plan for the entire state, or will our county be doing its own plan?
IDOLS is doing a plan for the entire state. And part of the problem is this is a nationwide incident the moment that it is announced. And there are many different philosophies across, first off, many different states as to how they're going to handle it. IDOLS is working it local within Iowa. And unlike most disasters which start locally and work their way on up, this is one that comes in sideways. They will be the lead for it. They are the lead regulatory agency when it comes to it. But if there has been a shift more towards the producer taking care of the depopulation and carcass disposal than what had previously been out there. So this is something that we're working with IDOLS on to make sure that we'll know what our roles and responsibilities are, what are the producer's roles and responsibilities, and how that'll all integrate.
Will IDOLS be finding sites for disposal of carcasses, or is that something our county needs to look at doing?
We discussed that during the last workshop. It will be pretty much the producer's issues. There is some maps that we have looked at as to if you're going to bury the carcasses, where that is permissible. And again, it's multiple layers. DNR has a say in something like that, as do we locally, and also, you know, there are other different factors that would come into play on some.
So as the planning goes along, it'll mesh more, and you'll figure out what the county needs to take a lead on and what IDOLS is.
Yes, and also some of the legal options that we would have, and also to look and see if there are any special powers that maybe Story County supervisors need to have to be able to enact, have them in reserve, and with the declaration of a local disaster that they could be implemented.
A couple of weeks ago, I asked Deb Shildroth if she would take on the project of looking at those types of powers we may need or use, and I believe that she was taking them to the KUPCOG committee or whatever, so I trust that they'll come back, and I started with some documents that Melissa Spencer had already provided, and so hopefully we're on the right path there, so just to let you know. Anything else from either of you? I have one more thing. I happened to, during our stormy period, hear Melissa Spencer on a local radio station. And I just want to tell you what an excellent job she did. She got that information out there, made it interesting. People were already interested, but I mean, the information really flowed. And I just want to let you know that I was very impressed with how she handled the interview and the information flow. So
she's also the go-to person when it comes to Facebook. Computer caveman like myself is probably not the best lead for that, but she has drugged me into the 21st century, and that is one of the great tools we have, but it was also a huge resource, I'm not going to say drain, but requirement for us to constantly update Facebook, and that's something we're going to have to look at, because and we may need to partner with some of the other public information operations folks around here, because during a large-scale disaster, while we're also coordinating response resources, we're not going to have the capability to devote the time to Facebook to also keep the public advised.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you what you do. Okay. All right, let's move on to consideration of minutes. Take a motion.
Move approval of both.
Second.
Okay. Further discussion? No. Sanders.
Aye.
Merkin.
Aye.
Olson. Aye. Next, personnel.
I move approval as listed.
Second.
All right. Merkin.
Aye.
Sanders.
Aye.
Olson. Aye. Consideration of claims.
I would move approval of claims as presented.
Second.
Merkin.
Aye.
Sanders?
Aye.
Olson? Aye. Consent agenda.
Move approval.
Second.
Sanders?
Aye.
Merkin?
Aye.
Olson? Aye. Did I skip claims? I just did them. Okay.
I think we did both.
Yeah, okay. All right. And we're moving on to public hearing items. So I welcome Lucy Martin and Ethan Anderson up. Oh, Lisa's Markley is sitting down for this one. Huh?
I'll let them have
one. Okay. All right. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning. So this morning you're having a public hearing for consideration of Resolution 1995. This is $3 million for StoryCom. You did pass a resolution on the 26th to publish this. This was lawfully published in the three official papers of county, and the resolution contains the code sections that you're allowed to borrow money for. This is an essential county purpose, so it doesn't have to go to referendum. And this resolution essentially sets the stage. You've already included it as your budget that you approved last week. This is just formalizing that levy approval and to allow the public to have input as part of the public hearing. If Ethan had anything to add.
I think Lucy's done a great job for compliance with the statutory framework here in the 331, 402, and 441, and then Iowa Code 76, which requires us to publish the hearing and then hold the public hearing and then be making sure we pass a resolution. That's here before you do.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and call the public hearing to order. I guess, as a click here. Do we have anyone in the audience that would like to address this? Seeing no one address the microphone, I'm going to close the public hearing and turn to the board for questions or discussion. Or vote.
Does this set a term for the bond
agreement? No, it allows us to use a levy, and we have included what the annual... I think the dollars levied is for a 10-year term, which is what we anticipate using, but it doesn't set the actual term per se.
Yeah, so I'm confused by that. If it's a 10-year term and it says we want to produce the amount of $268,000, $268,881 is what's listed in here, and I just do the quick math of 10 years, that's only $2.6 million. And so I thought we were going 10 years, but the amount in here confuses me in terms of how we're getting to $3 million. And so I just was wondering what I'm missing.
Turn it over to my board. That's how much we're showing as a levy for next year as far as a payment out of debt service. So there could have been some payment out of other areas to make the... It's a 10-year... It's calculated on 10 years, but we know nothing. We don't know how much... What the rate is going to be. We don't know how much we're going to borrow up front. If we're going to borrow the full $3 million. So we needed to get something in place that gave us an ability to levy, but it's based on this is how much we're going to take out of the debt service fund, and we could be taking minimal dollars out of
other things.
Other things, or the balance of the debt service fund that we've already got.
Okay.
Good question. Any other questions, comments? I entertain the motion.
Yeah, so I'll move approval of resolution 1995.
Second.
Okay. Sanders?
Aye.
Merkin?
Aye.
Olson? Aye. Okay, thank you. Next item, discussion and consideration of sewage disposal options for Hickory Grove Camping Beach and other areas. And it has my name here. I asked Mike Cox and Margaret James to work on it, actually. So, good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Okay, well, as you all know, we've been working... for many years now, trying to get to a place where we could identify and move forward with some needed wastewater improvements at Hickory Grove. And one of the options that we had been looking at and I guess investing in, biding time with, is a connection to Colo, which does a number of things for us. It removes the burden of wastewater treatment from the park and puts it in a city that already is situated to do so and has an effective system. It also is the most cost-effective route. In a recent meeting with the Colo City Council, it was very clear that in order for us to do that, they wanted some other favorable treatment with connecting a bike trail to the city, and that they have to do some more evaluation on their existing system and some I&I problems that they have. So I guess with those two things, we came away from that meeting with a pretty strong feeling that that is not looking favorable to go in that direction. So with that, we really need to take some time to look at some other options, and we have done that over the years. In 2016, we had 2015 and 16, we had engineers with Central Iowa Water identify some options for us. had a litany of different options, including on-site treatments, off-site treatments, continuous flow discharges, and then in addition, a forced main system to COLO. And they established some high-level price estimates and cost opinions with all of those options. Of course, the most effective one was COLO again. And then we started looking at on-site lagoon options, and so they had a price opinion on that of roughly $700,000 for the on-site system. I don't know this for sure. I need to confirm this. My understanding is that was a two-cell lagoon system at that time, and now the DNR is requiring three-cell lagoon systems. And so I speculate that we might have to increase that figure, not only for inflationary differences over the boy coming on 3 years now, but also to increase it by one cell. So that's one thing that we need to work through, and frankly, it makes another option that we've been looking at more appealing, and that is kind of a modular water treatment system, wastewater system that would provide a better result as far as water treatment, and I will not go out on a limb and say it's less expensive than a lagoon, but it might be comparable. Again, we're early in that process of identifying it, or identifying a cost figure, and so we're working with a firm to do that. What we're analyzing is the Advantex systems, which is a modular, scalable type system that you build it to whatever demand you need. At the moment, we have a broad range of cost opinion on that that would replace the existing gravity-fed system portion of the park. So that includes the Breezy Bay Campground, the Ranger Residence, and the Beach House, those three facilities. Eventually, what we'd like to do is update or add wastewater treatment around the rest of the park, so that we can connect cabins when we're ready to do that, so that we can add a second campground when we're ready to do that, etc. All of the options that I talked about are designed with the idea of being able to utilize or being sized to accommodate a full build-out. One of the advantages of this modular type system is maybe we don't have to do that all right now, but we can add on as we go. Another thing we're looking at is treating different parts of the park independently and not having one main treatment system. Another advantage of going with a modular type system rather than a lagoon system is that maybe we'd have room at different parts of the park to treat those needs there closer to where it's needed. For example, if we were to have a cabin at some point in the future, when we have a cabin, then maybe we could treat it right there with more of a residential type sized system. We have the maintenance shop right now, which is on a septic system. It'd be nice to get it off of that system eventually, but that's not a real high pressing need right now. The pressing need right now is to address the campground, beach house, and residence, utilizing the existing lagoon, which we'd need to take offline. What we'd like to do is have a system whatever system we end up going with, but have that addressed and ready to go when the lake restoration project is completed. And so at any rate, I wish I could come with some more solid figures, but we're just not there yet. We're just we're just trying to still work through that and get some better cost opinion data. So, any questions at that?
Did we ever have a price, an estimate on what it would cost us if COLA were willing to look us
to
up?
To what?
Did we ever have a price for COLA if they were willing?
If they were willing, yes, $450,000 is the 2016 estimate. So you can expect some inflationary.
Okay. How long would that bike trail be?
What's that?
How long would the bike trail be?
You know, I probably need to measure that. We're looking at $400,000 a mile. And what COLA did express was that they would be interested in entering a contract with us. Since it's going to take quite some amount of time to acquire right-of-way, negotiate and acquire right-of-way to build a trail.
They would put it over $1 million, probably.
What's that?
They would put it over $1 million.
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Definitely. And, you know, frankly, when we look at this, the board looks at all of our trail needs, and frankly, what we try to do is accomplish the most, serve the most number of people with the, ideally, with the least amount of investment, and that's where you put your priorities. And this, so far, has not really surfaced as a priority for our trails program.
So you said in addition, though, that COLO is not sure if their system could accommodate the park.
So they've got some inflow, what they call inflow problems or INI problems with their wastewater that they are working toward addressing, and they've addressed a number of those already. They passed an ordinance to give them the ability to restrict or prohibit residential sump pumps from going into the wastewater system. And so they're identifying, isolating, and removing those inflows. They also removed a field tile inflow that they found. So they had inflows into their system that was taking up precious capacity in their system. And so they are continuing to work through that. And I think that they'll continue to, they've got engineers engaged in that, and they'll continue to identify those residences or buildings, structures in town that have sumps going into wastewater, and they'll continue to take those offline, if you will. But they don't want to, they're not willing to move forward with us. Trail aside, they're not willing to move forward with us until they get some more answers on their inflow problems.
And when do we really need to have to make a final decision?
I'm sorry, can you
when
say
do
that?
We really need to make a final decision? How long do we have?
If we were to go to COLO, that could be done by next spring if we are all ready to begin that process, for that process, sign on that process by June. So by this June, we could have a spring operable system to COLO, but we'd have to have a June commitment.
A June
probably
this
prior
year.
To that, probably a May commitment in order to mm-hmm. have everything in line. So it's really coming up quickly.
Well, and if the goal is to have something in place when we finish the work, when DNR finishes the work that's going on out there, it means, I think we're up against a decision point, because if we're going to design and build some other type of system, other than putting a pipe in the ground to run it over to COLO, that's going to take us some time. And if we're bumping up against the next summer as being our deadline, yesterday is the day we needed to make a decision, figuratively.
The staff has done, I think, an admirable job mm-hmm. here of trying to work with COLO, trying to gather up the information required for the different varieties, options that we have available. And then, of course, there's all the work that's been done on the Hickory Grove drain down and the restorations, et cetera. So I personally think that this project, as far as the overall scheme, has been in play for several years. I felt also it was very clear when we walked out of the city council meeting in Colo that night that they had a list. Besides the trail, also the trail was kind of a new shocker for a couple of us, but they were hesitant to do anything or say anything until they knew about what kind of true inflow problem they had, and they had been talking about another minimum $200,000 for assist they wanted from the county for assistance with that, and there had been a couple of remarks made to me that $200,000 wouldn't even be close to what they really would expect from us. So, you know, the price is going up. The time is now here. And I think staff has done everything they could. So thank you for that.
Yeah, so I agree with that completely. I think it's time for us, meaning the three of us, to move on from this concept of tying on to Colo. I think we have tried and tried and tried, and I think it has just become evident that given the timing constraints that we have and now the what I view as new demands that are being made by Colo, it's unrealistic that we're going to get there. We need to go ahead and move. I tend to like the idea of a modular approach. It allows us to address the issues we have today without worrying so much about what might happen tomorrow. We can deal with that when it comes. If we do a lagoon system, we've got to build out to this theoretical capacity that we think we might have down the road. But I'm personally not ready to determine which way we're going there. I do believe it's time for us, Loris, to move on from Colo and direct staff to go ahead and bring us a recommendation of which way we need to head.
Okay. Do I hear a motion there?
Sure.
Okay.
Second.
All right. Sanders?
Aye.
Merkin?
Aye.
Olson? Aye. Direction is to go make a recommendation to us. Go back and look at us. Thank
you. Very
good.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Okay, next would be Leanne Harder, and we're discussion and consideration of the capital improvements plan starting with fiscal year 20. Good morning, Leanne.
What was placed on today's agenda for your consideration this morning was the draft capital improvements plan that has had a couple different iterations. But I do want to point out the changes from the last time you've seen it and then talk about some possible modifications to those changes as well, given the conversation that just occurred. In regard to the Hickory Grove Sewer on page 10, Mike did share with me an amount of, it was a range as he just stated, and we took the upper end of $840,000. I would suggest that the board consider revising that amount and putting in a TBD since we just heard the board giving Mike direction to come forward with some different options. With that, then, whatever number or language is considered and added to page 10, fixing the table on page 20 so that they are common and reflect the same amount. And then, thank you to Deb Schildroth for pointing out, somehow page 13 is an extra page of page 12. It's the same as page 12. Hmm. Earlier versions did not. I don't know what the Adobe gremlin got me. And then in fiscal year 2021, we do have the sewer expansion for Hickory Grove Park. I believe Mike did indicate via email that we could go ahead and remove that one out. Mm-hmm. So that would be on page 14. So the primary changes would be on page 10, the amount in regards to the Hickory Grove Sewer, and then the accompanying table on page 20, which will probably be page 19 once I remove that extra page 13. And then on page 14, removing the Hickory Grove Park Sewer expansion and the accompanying language in the table later on. And again, no, I did not receive any public input prior to the 5th, and even left it online till today, and have not received anything.
Okay. I have a question about the thought of taking that amount from the roughly $840,000, $850,000 to a TBD. And the TBD in general bothers me because then we've got a lot of, we know the range, but we don't put that in, and instead we just say a number still to be determined. It makes it hard then to really ascertain what resources are we going to need. And I think it makes it hard to the public to know what resources we're going to need on that. So that's why I'd rather plug in at least the $840,000 here as an estimate. We know all of them are an estimate until we get final costs and bids, but that's just one more TBD that then we don't know. People look at the numbers and we know they're not an accurate number, but they're not even a close to accurate number, the more TBD we have.
And if we, change to TBD, I'll be going back to previous ones and saying, now, what was the kind of number we were talking about? What range were we talking about? And I guess I would agree in that case that it's good to have, if you're looking at it, to have some idea of what it's going to cost, knowing it might change.
I was just looking through. The TBDs we have are for fiscal year 19, mm-hmm. The Army Corps of Engineers land acquisition.
We know that, and we know why that's a TBD. Yes. It doesn't help with the public to understand or us on a final number, but we know that. Yeah.
And then the administration building infill project.
Okay. All right, for 19 or for 20?
For 20.
All right. For 20. So what about the Justice Center remodel?
And that one as well. I was getting to that one.
See, and that's the other one that I know. We don't know exactly what it's going to cost, but we have some kind of idea, basically, on from what Joby and the county attorney have been working on already, don't we? And I'm looking out here. Alyssa's not here. Maybe.
I think we have an idea on the county attorney's portion of that. I don't think we have any idea on everything else.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Okay. And honestly, so I would actually be fine as we go up to 19, Corps of Engineers. We've sent them a check for how much?
152.
Okay, so I would be fine if we stick the 152 in there. They've got to show more than that if they're going to try to come get more than that from us.
Well, my understanding from our discussions in the budget was that the 152.3 is dead and gone, and this is for anything else they're going to want from us.
Yeah,
that
so
was my understanding from the budget work sessions, and I don't see.
So I think practically that's true, but they've still got to show that 152. They've got to show that was the cost involved in transferring the grant. They don't get to just keep it. Now, realistically, are they going to send us any money? Absolutely not. They're not going to send us any money back. But to go over that 152, they've got to make a bona fide case that they truly spent more than the 152. Mike, am I right or am I missing on all that?
You're right. The only caveat there, I would say, is that 152 contemplated that we were going to address the cultural survey, the phase one archaeology survey, and that is predicated on, frankly, some assistance from the Corps, and thus far we haven't had that. And so if we end up paying for that survey, that's not included in that 152, and that is going to be somewhere around $40,000-$50,000, which would be in addition to the 152. So, yes, our agreement with the Corps says that it will be 152. They have to justify and come back to us for anything more than that. But then there's this other outlier as well.
So if we made it 200,000, we'd be getting somewhere close, is what I'm hearing. And two, when's the last time we got an update from them on where we are in process?
2 weeks ago. Working on it.
Okay.
They're working on it in-house. I will say that their project manager is putting a concerted effort forward. It's the first time in the history of working with the Corps that I can say that.
Good.
So I feel good about that. I still feel like
takes a lot of communication to get going on this archeo survey, which time is of the essence now.
What was the clock that we triggered when we sent them the check? We triggered a clock.
2 years.
And where are we in that
October
2 years?
October of this year is the end of 2 years.
I was going to say, so I don't want to put in that TBD the 200. I'd rather put like the 40 or 50, whatever the remaining is, because we've already sent.
So you're saying that was 18. Okay. Yeah, so I would suggest us put 50 in. Just going back to Loris's point, we need to have as many numbers in there as we can, and I think 50 is a reasonable estimate of what we've got left.
Okay. And thank you, you two, for working so hard on that for so long. And you too, Lisa.
I would support putting 50,000 in there, but if the 152 you're saying was FY18
money,
yeah, it shouldn't be in here then. I agree.
Yeah, so I don't see a way for us to remove the TBD on the Justice Center project. I think you also said we've got a TBD on any kind of expansion to this building. Mm-hmm. I don't see any way that we could do anything other than
that.
A TBD on those at this point. But other than that, hopefully we've got it cleaned up.
So we can leave the $840,000 in for the Hickory Grove sewer for now?
I'd be fine with that.
I'm hoping we're going to do better than that.
Yeah,
but well, it's an upper limit then.
Yeah,
it's an upper limit then. And that tells us that.
So we're leaving it.
Okay.
So I would move approval of this with the noted changes.
And I would second that.
Okay. Sanders?
Aye.
Merkin?
Aye.
Olson? Aye. Thank you.
Could I ask just one question on the end? 12 and 13 being duplicates, which is the total for the projects in FY 2020 then? Is it 6.5 or 4.7? Just save me doing the math.
I think it's 6.5. I can go back and check the spreadsheet.
Okay, thanks.
I can make sure I have the right page on that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Leanne.